Hello and welcome to another episode of Start Writing. I'm Jay Washburn, the author of Starchild.
And I'm Joe Bondosky, author of the Skyfall Event series.
And this is episode 10 in our Beginner's Guide.
10. Wow.
So this is probably our second to last episode. Next time I want to talk about kind of like the meaning, like what drives you to be a writer. That'll be the final lecture in this series. Today I want to talk about editing together. So last week we talked about like, what is your job as a solo author? Like, how do you switch into editor mode and kind of clean up your novel? And today I want to talk about how do we collaborate with peers and readers in order to refine our draft. I just want to drop back to a couple points from last time. And those are, I watched and read the novel of Raiders of the Lost Ark. And Joe, you'll probably find this interesting. In the novel, Indy says, like, I don't know if you remember, he gets on the submarine at the very end to follow the Nazis. In the book, it says he lost his lucky hat in the ocean. And I was like, wait, he literally lost the famous hat? That's crazy. This is in the novel. So I go back to the movie. I'm like, what happens in the movie? He leaves it on the boat. Like he's on Katanga's boat when the Nazis show up with their submarine. So that's the last time you see that hat in the movie too. And then he swims in the whole last scene, no hat. And then once he gets back to Washington, D.C., he has a different hat. It's a gray hat. It's not the famous fedora. Anyway, and then in the sequels, like they make this hat, like this hat, this is the hat. And it's like, yeah, man, he lost the hat in the first movie if you're watching
closely.
Yeah, well,
not only that, but I mean, in the third movie, we see him as a kid and he gets the hat.
He gets the hat, yeah.
Yeah. Well,
the hat didn't survive to the third movie.
Whoa.
Anyway, sorry.
I never realized that little plot hole was there.
That's totally a tangent. What I wanted to say was, so Indy gets on a submarine and that submarine goes to an island in the Mediterranean. They open up the ark and the wrath of God comes out and kills all the Nazis. Right. And then, right. So Indy is now stranded on an island and presumably there's a Nazi U-boat docked and that's his way off the island, but it's being run by a bunch of Nazis. Right. And he's got the Ark of the Covenant. It's not like he can just carry that out. He needs help. And the movie just cuts from the wrath of God killed everybody, Indy and Miriam kiss, and then they show up in Washington, D.C. It just skips all that. And I just wanted to point this out as an example of, like, it's probably a cool scene to have Indy go to this U-boat and, like, kill all the Nazis on the U-boat so that he can get a radio and contact his people in D.C. You know, there's something cool that happened there. But for the sake of a tidy novel and wrapping it up well, you just got to skip all that. Like, they literally cut whatever Indy did there. They skipped to the end. And I just thought it was a good example of really tight editing. Because I think as an author, you're tempted to, well, it's like, well, it's he's invading a Nazi U-boat. That's a cool scene. I can't cut it. But it's just like, no, for the sake of your novel, You just got to move on. And I guess I was just impressed by how much it was cut out of Raiders. Like they show you the good stuff and then they cut and they move to the next thing. And it just like keeps that pacing and the action. But that's what you got to do as an editor.
Yeah, that is such a good example, right? Like there's this great scene, but it's like, no, the climax is over. That's just a small piece. We don't need it.
Yeah. Yeah, we're done. We're moving to the end, and they jump right into that finale.
Yeah, well, especially because, like you said, like we have the huge climax of the wrath of God. You're not going to top it, so they don't try.
Yeah,
they're like, he did it. He won. Moving on.
And we just got to be careful as authors, because like if you write that scene, and then someone tells you, "Hey, you got to cut that. The ending's too long." It's hard. So like, just watch out for that. Okay, then another thing I want to mention. Like Joe, you and I, we've both played a ton of video games. Like that, and in every game, you go to a menu, you select your spell, and then you hit A, right? And it casts the spell. In Ocarina of Time, they had that same system where they're developing the game. It's like, okay, now press A, and you'll do your song. You do the spell. And someone at some point came up with the idea that, like, hey, let's not just you press a button. Let's say you literally, like the character gets out this musical instrument And then the player has to play the notes of the song, and that song then unlocks the spell, like makes the spell. And here's what I noticed. The mechanics is you activate the spell. That's the mechanics. And it's the same with the song or without the song, right? It's the same. But there's something that makes the mechanics extra cool, because it's like, oh, I'm literally playing this ocarina as the player. And I thought this was another cool example of, like, maybe you have something in your novel where mechanically it's just perfect. It moved the plot from here to there. The hero went from this to that. But maybe there's a way that you can make it a little bit cooler, like a little more dramatic, like
immersion.
And honestly, like, we're not writing video games, we're writing novels. But if your hero goes through it, then your reader goes through it vicariously. So that's another thing to think about. Like, how can I make something as boring as hit A to cast the spell? How can I ramp that up? How can I make it a little more magical for the reader and for the hero together?
Yeah, I think it's a tricky path to walk, because you could end up, you know, just narrating something that is even more boring, right?
Yeah. Make sure it is magical, because you don't want to add fluff, for sure. So I'm reading Harry Potter 5 with my family, and I told you last time that I love finding typos in professionally published books, because it makes me feel like it's okay to be an indie, because everybody's always like, oh, indie, like, your books are trash, you don't even have an editor, and da-da-da.
Well, it's like, man. I think there is a group of indie who don't edit and just publish, and they are rough.
Yeah, and that's true. And they're giving us a bad name. Yeah.
And they're giving us a bad name because, you know, I know a lot of indies who, you know, page per page typos, indies have fewer than published because they're terrified of that.
Yeah.
You know, whereas the publishers, we paid the guy, he put in the time, whatever, made it through. You know, and that's their view on it, right? Like, you know, we met the standard required by us to, you know, qualify as a well-edited book. And we have got to move on to the next project. We're looking, you know, at resource management here. Whereas, you know, you'll have indies who just comb through over and over and over again.
Huh. Yeah. Well, and I've noticed that for myself, I get to continually edit my ebook, like literally forever if I want to, which is kind of nice. Like, it never goes to press and then it's out of my hands. I can always change my mind. This is like a call to you listeners. If someone can explain this to me, I want to understand. This the Order of the Phoenix Illustrated, it literally is just full of comma splices, and I don't get it. Like, it's fine with me if J.K. Rowling wants to write that way, but I just can't believe her editor didn't change these. And yeah, if any of you listeners have any insights as to why she would have 5 comma splices on one page,
yeah,
I just don't get it, but... anyway, it's there. Yeah. No,
that looks intentional.
Yeah. Well, and to be fair, let me back up. 4 of these are in dialogue. And I think, well, you could have a person who speaks that way where they just kind of run their sentences together. But here's the thing. She's jumping. Lupin does it. Tonks does it. And then Mr. Weasley does it. And like literally every character she has does it. It's like, yeah. If Hagrid wants to do comma splices, let Hagrid do it all day long, right? He's like that kind of lower cast, whatever.
But with being so many characters on the page, it looks less intentional for a character and more she was just writing that way.
I know. And again, like, if JK wants to write that way, I don't care. But her editor, come on. Like, why did someone not put periods in there where the commas are?
Yeah.
I just don't get it. But okay, that's the end of my rant. And that's the end of my little recap on editing. So we talked about how, like, you can edit the sentence level, the paragraph level, the chapter level, the arc level, and the story level. And for me, it's just like, absolutely essential that you get feedback on the story level, right? You need to look at the global picture of your story. And so this is kind of a hot take, but I had a friend who just reached out to me. He's starting on his first novel, and he said, hey, do you have a writing group? And do you know how I can get one? And this is kind of weird. I know that this is weird. And Joe, I kind of want to hear your take on writing groups, but I told him I don't have a writing group. And the reason I don't is because I don't really want writing group feedback. I want feedback on my entire novel. Like, I want to write an entire novel, and I want to have somebody read it and give me feedback on that. So let me pause. So I'm going to talk for a second here about like my ideal writing group, which is kind of an anti-writing group, I guess you could say. But there are definite benefits to having a writing group. And Joe, I know that you have a writing group that you're like very loyal to. Can you just like put a chip in, like a blurb in? Tell us about what's so valuable about having a writing group.
Well, I mean, there's a lot. Like, writing groups really helped improve my writing significantly, because if you're just writing, you're writing in the dark. I think Jay, coming at it from, you know, I don't have a writing group, this is what I want, is leaving out the fact that he has multiple degrees in writing. You know, like, Jay was an English teacher, right? A writing group providing feedback, particularly early in your career, and you'll see this a lot with writers, their writing groups become less important the longer they write, because they kind of reach the level where they have an understanding about how their work is received. And, you know, whenever you're going to dip a toe in a new genre, or you want to try something really experimental, you're going to want feedback on those, because you're stepping out of that comfort zone you've developed. So Jay got a lot of feedback on his writing early on. And so when he stepped out of the academic environment, he already had a good feel for how he was writing and how it was being received.
And that's true. So a lot of my classes, we would turn in stuff to the class, and we would like our class, each class would be a writing group essentially, where we're reading and critiquing each other's writing. So I have had that experience a lot. And you make a good point that it's particularly helpful as you're starting.
But at the same time, like, just being able to talk things over with people. I don't know if the interview or the audio worked out, but there was a moment where Jay was asking about my plot for my novel. And I was, you know, I had a rough outline draft that I was writing. I was, you know, 20,000 words into, you know, 60, 70,000. And I began to shift elements of the plot just as I talked to him, because just having to verbalize that to another person and just kind of watching their face confused or understanding can really help clean up a novel. You know, definitely there's more than one screenwriting book I read where they said, you know, when you have your plot, tell your friends, and if they don't get excited, rewrite the outline, you know, because they need to get excited hearing you talk about it. And you need to be able to talk about it. Go ahead.
Yeah. I find it interesting that you say, tell your friends. Like, you don't have to have a formal writing group. You just need someone that will listen to you that enjoys a good story.
Yeah.
Joe, I have a follow-up question. I didn't prepare any notes on this, but let's say you're a new writer, like you're in the tech industry, right? Nothing related to English. You want to write a novel and you want to learn from a critique group or a writing group. How do you find this? How do you go about finding this group? Like, because you're not connected to that type of circle yet. How do you get in?
Honestly, just go online, right? There are Facebook groups set up for local writing groups. There are meetup groups set up for writing groups. Scribblefile is a good one, but you're not going to have a verbal exchange with these people. It'll all just be via writing. And that's a website you can use. So there's a lot of tools out there for it. So Jay was just saying, you know, talk to somebody, but I do want to bring up why writers are better to talk to about this. And that is that they have the language to break down an emotional reaction. So a reader can be like, this is boring. A writer can look at this and be like, this is good, but the pacing's too slow. You're taking too long to get from one plot point to the next. See how your descriptions are getting really long? He says, you can give me a good description up front, but then you've got to really just stay focused on the action moving through, and that's going to accelerate your pacing. Right? The emotional reaction is the same. Both people feel the chapter's boring, but the writer has studied enough to have the language to communicate why it's boring. You have bogged down the middle with descriptions.
Cool. I think getting feedback from my writer friends is just awesome. However, I guess I'm like adding a caveat to what you just said. I think sometimes having, I guess you could call it a more ignorant response, is sometimes sufficient. I guess maybe it depends on how good you are at understanding story, but
yeah,
sometimes like just a lay reader. Well, I guess I would say sometimes my writer friends are saying, well, I would have written it this way. And it's like, I'm not asking how you would write it. I'm asking how you read it.
That's true. That's definitely something that happens. That is a really good point, Jay.
Yeah.
We definitely come at it and be like, well, I would have written it this way.
Yeah. Okay. But like, having said that, like, I think you can never get enough feedback. Like, I wish I could have 1,000 people critique my book before I publish it. I mean, because of time constraints, you can't really do that. But there's plenty of room to have your writer friends and your reader friends read your manuscript at different points of the revision process. Anyway, so I just kind of, I want to say writing groups, I think, are awesome. And they can help in the beginning stage a lot. And they can help a ton with your copy editing and your chapter editing. But so having said that, I should say and, not but, and it's important to get global feedback. You need a content edit of your book. So that means at some point you need to finish your manuscript and you need to send it to a friend. And that's what I'm going to talk about here. So I just created a website where people can sign up to be beta readers. So you go to betareader.jwashburn.com. And literally anyone on the internet can sign up to be on this beta reader list. Now, having said that, that doesn't mean I'm just going to send my book to anybody who puts their email on there.
Right.
Mostly I prioritize my friends and my writer friends, you know, people who have given me edits before and who I like their stuff. But like I trust their feedback at this point. But I'm always open to new people who are eager to, you know, give me that feedback because I just feel like it's so valuable. So that's what I do. That's how I collect people onto a list of beta readers. And then I only ask two questions. Actually, I should say I only give them two instructions. And these are them. I say, I want to know what you're thinking and feeling as you read. So if you're bored, just put a note in. I'm bored right here. Or I'm confused. Or I love this. Or, you know, just whatever. I just need to know your stream of consciousness. Yeah, is that the right word?
Just your moment-to-moment reactions to the novel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is so valuable because I've never experienced that before. I've never been surprised by my novel because I'm the one who made it. I mean, sometimes you get surprised by an idea here and there. But in the first draft,
surprises come in the first draft. Yeah. You're like, oh, that's a good idea. And now we've messed up my outline, dumb me.
Yeah. Oh, that's so funny. And then the second instruction, I say, I'll call you at the end and ask you some questions. So that's all. That's all I tell them. Tell me what you're thinking and feeling, and I'll call you at the end. I have a couple editors who I share my actual manuscript with. So I go into Google Docs. I draft in Google Docs. So I just go in there, I click share, and I send it to them. And they'll literally, mark up my actual manuscript. I usually save these people for the end. Like they're finding the commas that are out of place and stuff like that. And here's the thing. It's a little cumbersome to read an entire novel as a Google Doc, right? It doesn't save your spot. You usually have to do it on a computer to do it comfortably. So most of my readers, I do this. So I publish on Google Play Books as well as Kindle. So I throw it onto Google Play Books and I can add a content reviewer on there. And what that does is it makes it like I have to get someone's Gmail address. I add them as a reviewer on Google Play Books and that makes it pop up in their Google Play Books app. So that's an ebook reader. And like that app works on Android or iPhone or iPad or like a Chromebook or any desktop. Like you can literally read a Google Play Book anywhere, which is kind of convenient. So I tell them, go into your settings and then look for a setting called Save Notes, Highlights, and Bookmarks in Google Drive. And once you turn that on, what that does is if I'm reading an ebook and I highlight something and annotate it, it makes a Google Doc that collects all of those from that single book. And then I tell them, okay, now go into your Google Drive and find that automatically created Google Doc and share it with me. And then, so what I get looks something like this here that you see on the screen, where I can see the passage that they highlighted, and then I can see what they said underneath, and then it timestamps it too. So like, this is when they said it. So I can actually keep an eye on the pace of their reading, which can be helpful. I mean, you don't want to read too much into it, but sometimes it's like, wow, they dropped off. Everybody keeps dropping off on this chapter.
Yeah.
Like, and it's taken them 5 days to get back to it. Like that, there's a story there, and they don't even have to tell you. You can just see that from their timestamps. Yeah. It's like, oh, and then here's the thing. They speed up at the end every time. It's like, wow, they just read the last 10 chapters in one. Yeah. And like that data is telling you something. Anyway, so that's how I do most of my beta reader feedback. I send it to them through Google Play Books, and then I look at the Google Drive document.
Oh, I was just saying, looking for the trends in reader data is good. Yeah, because like if one person does it, a million reasons could be behind that choice. But you know, when you see a pattern, it's like, oh, something's going on in the book.
Yeah, yep, that's true. And you have to be careful, because it's like, well, so-and-so actually stopped reading my book for 5 days because he had a final exam. It's like, well, don't read into that. Yeah. So yeah, you have to be careful for sure. Okay. So some listener of ours back in episode one of the Beginner's Guide, it's almost a year ago, they sent us a message and said, can you give us a list of the questions that you ask when you call someone on the phone and ask them about their read?
Right.
And so now 10 episodes later, almost a full year later, here are these questions.
Almost a year later.
Yeah.
Wow.
But hey, I didn't forget. okay. So I, you know, we've talked about the braid, the three pillars. So I ask them about characters, world, and plot. One of my favorite questions is to say, name as many characters as you can. So I'm just sitting there. I usually type. I'm listening as they talk, and I just type down the names, and you'll see the same certain names come up as like the top three, right?
Yeah.
and that tells you something about your stories. That there was a character in Star Child that everybody kept listing right at the front. And I was like, I didn't know he was a main character, and they love him. so yeah, that's good data.
I'm just curious.
Dre.
Oh.
Yeah.
I guess in the version of Star Child, he's pretty big in the first one.
Yeah. Well, and he just keeps getting bigger because everybody likes him. So I like kind of hone in on those points. But okay, so next question. Which names did you like or dislike? Who's your favorite character? That's always a fun one. Did you happen to cast any celebrities into any of the roles? A lot of readers just say no. Like I didn't imagine anyone, but you'll get people casting, you know, I threw Harry Potter in there, or, you know, whatever. And you're like, well, that's interesting. for world, I say, what setting stands out to you? Did any setting seem vague to you? What would you do if you had the sort of magic presented in this book? And then what would you like to know more about the magic? I'll be perfectly honest with you. I think I'm a little bit weak on world, and I think these questions are usually not as insightful as these other questions I've listed. So that's something I got to work on. I got to get better at world, I think. For plot, I say, what was your favorite scene or moment from the book? And they'll usually pick a chapter, and it's kind of cool to figure out what was the most memorable thing for him. At the beginning of the story, what was the main question you wanted answered? And did you feel like it was? What's the main thing you'd change in the plot? And this is fun, because now you're asking them to be a creator, and your writer friends will like jump on this question. Your reader friends are going to maybe struggle with it a little, but if you can get them to tell you something that they would change, it's usually a really good thing to look at in your editorial process. What did you find confusing? What was your gut reaction to the ending? And maybe my favorite question, what do you think is going to happen next? This question is so cool, because they will often come up with things that I haven't even considered. And often they'll they'll mention the things I have considered. And that kind of confirms that I'm going in the right direction. Sometimes they'll give me ideas that I should maybe think about or consider. Another thing I wanted to talk about was basically the ups and downs that come with editing, but particularly with receiving critical feedback. Okay, so I have this chart on my screen that shows at the top, there's a solid line showing here's how good Game of Thrones is. And then I have a red line showing how good I think my story is. And with each draft, this line pops up really high. And then after the draft, it drops way low. And I kind of go back and forth like this, where I just think my novel's great and it's awesome. And sometimes I think it's better than Game of Thrones. And other times I just think it's the worst. Point is, you'll have these ups and downs and you should expect them. You should expect to kind of feel sad sometimes when you've worked on this for so long and someone tells you something's not that great about it. This is kind of a joke, but I made this checklist that says, here's what you got to do when you're getting feedback. First item, read your feedback. Second item, don't reply. Third item, take a break for a few days. Fourth item, let it sink in. It's really important for people to give you honest feedback. And if you're at all reactive or defensive, you're going to shut that down and they're not going to be honest with you this time or in the future. And it's just important that you be very open to other people's thoughts and ideas and be accepting of them and don't be defensive.
Yeah. Well, I think like you're saying, don't reply, but I think don't be defensive is maybe the better way, because like sometimes that you want to have a conversation, be like, okay, this is what I'm trying to do. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah.
You know, clearly it didn't happen because that's why we're having this conversation. How do you think I get there?
Yeah. Yep. Exactly. So I have on the screen an email that I sent to one of my editors, and I say, to be perfectly honest, receiving critical feedback is painful, but I really need to experience that pain or my book won't get any better. So I'm asking you to be really honest. and that's what you got to do. You got to ask people to be really honest with you, even if it hurts, because I mean, it's your baby. You spent a lot of time on this. It's hard to write a novel. Neil Gaiman says, when people tell you something's wrong or doesn't work for them, they're almost always right. And then he says, when they tell you exactly what they think is wrong and how to fix it, they're almost always wrong. and so I just love that. If they say, I'm bored here, they're right. If they say, and you should add an action sequence, more explosions, like, no, like that's up to you as the author to figure out. You're supposed to figure out the solution. And I just think that's super cool. There's also I guess you call it a meme, a phrase on the internet where people say, don't stop until you're proud. And I think that's something like that kind of resonates with me. I think you should keep editing until you're proud of what you've created. but there's, again, a balance there where you could edit for the rest of your life and you don't want to do that. You want to finish, you know, make something you're proud of, but you want to be done with it and move on to the next thing because you're probably going to be even more proud of that next thing. This is just kind of an addendum. That's basically all I have to say about editing with a group. I just wanted to mention, because when you finish your book, you need a cover and a title. And I think it's just important to get started on these early. Like, I actually think you shouldn't wait till the end, because if you start early, it gives you time to do more iterations and kind of think about the concept. So I would just say, get started on your covers and titles early.
What you're seeing here, though, is Jay designs his own covers. And so he's moving through these like drafts in a novel. I have a very different approach. You know, I look at the genre I'm writing in. I look at the top 100 books in it. I look at what I think is the trends within those images. And then I go to book designers and I put in the tags, right? And I look at the images that I think are looking for them, you know, looking similar, that I really like of that, you know, I keep looking until something just catches my eye, like, boom. I'm like, oh, yeah, that one. Hope it's not sold. And then, and then I'll pick up two or three and I take those to testing. You know, I'll be like, I'm going to run Facebook ads and see what people like, you know, and, you know, get the opinion of, you know, 10,000 people. And that I you know, so that's, for me, that's something I do at the end. You know, for me, my cover and my title, I have made the mistake of making them part of the story, and I won't do that anymore. Whoa. They are not part of the story for me. They're part of the marketing, you know, and I need to, and because they're part of the marketing, I need to let the market pick them.
Dang, that's really cool. I actually love that.
So, yeah. So for me, I do it at the end because, you know, I don't need it before then. And, you know, I want to have a novel ready to sell when I'm going to market, right? Because markets can shift. And, you know, I want the at the moment data on covers, titles, blurbs, hooks, all of that right when I'm ready to publish so that I have it when the market is ripe for it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Dang, that's cool. No, I agree with that. I think that's very sound advice. Isaac Asimov wrote a series that started with a novel called David Starr, Space Ranger. After he writes the first book, he realized that the character's name is Lucky, or like his nickname, Lucky Star. And then each of the books have like a planet name in them and whatever part of the topic is. So like the Pirates of the Asteroid, the Oceans of Venus, the Big Son of Mercury. But the first one doesn't fit with that. And he published these about like 1 year apart. Each took him about a year. And I just feel like it's a shame that he didn't realize the right title till after that first year. So I actually rewrote, I renamed the first one to make it fit, Lucky Star and the Phantoms of Mars. Anyway, but it's just like, I really value parallelism in the titles. And I just think if you start early and kind of, you should think of your series from the beginning. And I mean, you don't have to write the whole series at the beginning, but just like kind of be brainstorming, kind of be working on it as you go. I actually highlighted here how the Game of Thrones series is not parallel in all its titles, and The Expanse isn't. And then I looked at Dune. I was like, man, could I fix the Dune titles? Like, instead of calling it Dune Messiah, could you call it Messiah of Dune? And does that, like, Dune, God Emperor, does that fit? Dune, I don't know.
Of Dune. Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, and honestly, this is just an OCD thing. You don't have to do this, but it's just kind of a fun thing I thought that I would share.
So, but again, within this, Jay is again thinking about this as a work of art and, you know, part of the story. And my approach, as I pointed out, is different. You know, I don't sit down and imagine these. I go to the market and I see what the market is doing.
Because, well, so you're saying your title is very much chosen by the market.
Yeah. So again, once again, you go look at the top 100. What are they doing? You know, are there any trends in their titles? You know, and then there's even people who have collected keywords. What keywords do people search for when reading these kinds of books? Because there are databases on that. And so you then take those two data points and be like, okay, what is my book about? And how do I fit it into these two pieces?
Dang, that's cool. Well, and to be very candid, I'm not that good at marketing. and I think that your marketing first focus is awesome.
Yeah. Like when I write the book, I write the book I want to write. But then when it comes to anything that involves selling that book, it is about the market, and I've got to walk away from it. And I guess, you know, maybe I am wrong to tell all authors to do that, but I do tell all authors to do that because I see so many be like, I can't sell my book. I'll be like, okay. Be like, how much control did you have on your cover? How much control on your title? Yeah. Did you write your blurb? Right. And if you are controlling those three things, did you do all three to market, or do you do it to story? Because if you did it to your story, there's a reason you're not selling. I say it 1,000 times over. Those three things are not about your book. They're not about your story. They're not about your characters. They're about the market, right?
Yeah.
You have written a book for a certain group of readers. Regardless of what is in that book, you need to convince them in a second that this is the kind of book they like to read. And if you can, right, cover, title, blurb, then they'll buy your book. And if they buy it, they might read it. And they read it, they will love it. But if you screw up any of those first three steps, they won't buy it, right?
Well, and I think it's funny. I am conspicuously missing a lecture on marketing. I didn't include that in a beginner's guide. So, but maybe I'll come up with something. Okay. Well, so that's all I have for today. Thank you for listening. Our email is in the show notes. So if you have questions or follow-ups, we would love to answer your questions. So reach out to us. We want to hear from you. And thank you for listening. It's time to start writing.
Yes. All right. Great job, Jay.